Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the 16mm Film Crew. I'm Cindy.
And I'm Dale.
You can watch us on YouTube. You can like and comment on our YouTube videos and subscribe to our YouTube channel. You can support us on Anchor. You can listen to us everywhere podcasts are found at 16mm Film Crew Podcast. Leave us a rating review and visit us on our website at www.16mmfilmcrew.com. So this week we watched the highly anticipated Wes Anderson film Asteroid City. And here's your synopsis. World-changing events spectacularly disrupt the itinerary of a junior stargazer / space cadet convention in an American desert town circa 1955. And we have a whole host of cast, so let's just rip through this list. We have Jason Schwartzman, Scarlett Johansson, Tom Hanks, Jeffrey Wright, Tilda Swinton, Bryan Cranston, Edward Norton, Adrian Brody, Leah Schreiber, Hope Davis, Steve Park, Rupert Friend, Maya Hawke, Steve Carell, Matt Dillon, Hong Zhao, William Dafoe, Margot Robbie, Tony Revioli, Jack Ryan, and Jeff Goldblum. And this movie is written and directed by Wes Anderson. So, Dale, I said last week that I was very interested to hear what your thoughts on this movie. So please let it rip.
Yeah. Remember how the other day I was commenting on Wes not being a fan of people mimicking his artistic style? This movie seems to me just all that. And I understand, well, that's probably why he got mad, because this movie, more than anything, you know, Wes, you know, the whole dollhouse idea of his movies, those being picturesque and beautiful, but a lot of his movies have a lot of heart and substance in the story. This movie was kind of a void of all of that. It was mostly just a visual set piece, kind of slash a story within a story, because it's a story about a theater troupe, which is also acting out the movie they're in. And it's like a weird confluence of stuff that doesn't really leave you with anything, you know? So.
Okay. What was your thoughts before you watched it? Like, what did you have any like anticipation or ideas of like how you would feel while you're watching it, being a fan of Wes's work? I'm just wondering.
I mean, I was expecting a lot more, knowing the topic and knowing how this kind of setting, he does make everything kind of still kind of set in like 1940s, 1950s-ish, but it still feel very contemporary in a way. That's just usually set dressing in a way. So I thought he was going to delve more into the whole, you know, especially the way Bryan Cranston starts this movie off. You think it's going to be a, kind of like War of the Worlds, that kind of thing. You know, a really, like, and it kind of is, but not to the level I thought. Like, this movie, I thought it was going to be more heavy on the weird cookie sci-fi stuff of that time period. And there was only really like 2 seconds of that. And beyond that, it's basically, you know, Jason Schwartzman and Scarlett Johansson flirting for like the whole movie, you know? So, yeah.
Okay. So, I was excited to see this movie. And then after Cannes, some reviews had started coming out and they weren't looking great. But I was like, you know, I'm gonna watch it for myself and just see how I feel about it. When I went to the movie theater, there was one lady who like laughed during the entire film. Like even when there weren't really jokes, she just opened that gab and just went off. So that was interesting. But I do recall being on my phone for a few of those moments, being like, okay, I'm ready for this movie to end now. And it's so crazy because like most of the reviews that I've seen from this movie by other creators love this movie, think it's great, think it's one of Wes's best works, like are really gung-ho about this. There was one reviewer, I also had a friend who was like very excited to like listen to the podcast because he watched the movie and he loved it.
Yeah.
And I watched this one creator called the Oscar Expert, who I watched. It's, they're twin brothers, and I watch them pretty often. And his response to the film, because he was at Cannes, so he watched it, and then he reviewed it right after he saw it. His response to it was exactly how I felt, which was like, this wasn't that good. And like, because of who Wes is and his like cult following, that's probably going to get lost somewhere. Like the reality of the movie just not being as pristine or as you might have expected one of his films to be. And for me, the real thing that was the, I don't know, the real defining moment of like why I wasn't a huge fan of this film was the fact that this is a story about like a father and his kids and their mother dies. So I think it's supposed to be like a study in grief, or at least on its face, it's supposed to be a study in grief, but nothing really happens with that. And because you're watching it as a play, you know, these are people performing the film, there doesn't feel like there are any stakes. Like nothing, you don't feel like you're really invested in anything because you know that it's not real. Like, you know, whatever story they're telling you is just some script that Edward Norton like typed up in his pajamas. And my thing is like, when I was watching that movie, like what the play is actually supposed to be, which is them in the desert dealing with this like alien invasion, I was enjoying it. It's yeah. Just when we got taken out of that because we had to keep being reminded that this is a play and that these are actors. That's what really killed it for me. Like, I was just like, you coming in and out of the story is not working. Like, it's just, it did not, the framing device did not work for whatever it was, because I just felt immediately taken out every single time we had to go back to the play version of it. I was just like, can we just stay in this story? It just feels more interesting. Like, and no, the answer is no, that doesn't happen. And his whole like point of the actual film, like what the film is about, is like not to take art too seriously, I guess. Like, don't think about it that deeply. There's like a whole portion in it where it's just like, turn off your brain and just like, don't ask questions, just accept it. And other films have done this, and I hate it every single time. I hate that. Should I even call it a message? I don't even know. I hate that idea of like, you don't need to understand what's going on, just watch it. And it's like, no, I want to understand what's going on. Like, I don't go to films, especially not films with like auteur directors, to shut my brain off. That's not why I'm here. Personally, that's not why I'm personally here. Now, I'm sure that there are other people who are fine with that and who are cool with it and are just like, yep, yeah, sure. Unless you're watching a movie like Tenet, you know, where it's like, you're never going to understand the science of whatever it is that they're talking about. So that's not really the point. So unless it's something like that, where it's like, you cannot understand it unless you are like an expert in physics or whatever, like, I'm fine with that. Even when I was watching a movie like Tar, where I'm like, what are you saying? I was still invested in the characters, and like, because it wasn't really, the music of it was kind of just the entry point. It wasn't actually what the story was about. It was about a woman who was abusing her power.
Yeah.
And that was very compelling. So I feel like the idea of just like, don't think about it, just doesn't make any sense when I'm coming to certain films. Like, if you're going to a Marvel film, sure, you don't have to think that deeply. There's no requirement for you to do so. But when you're coming to movies like this, I feel like the expectation is that our brain should be switched on, and that you as a director are bringing something like new and creative to this story, and that you're actually trying to tell a story versus being like, it's just art, like, let it happen to you. I'm not into that.
Yeah, you brought up a perfect point a while ago. You mentioned Tar, and I'm a backtracker. You also mentioned that this movie is a study in like grief and in loss, but it really doesn't spend much time on that study of grief and loss. I mean, Jason Schwartzman tells his kids, "Hey, your mother died 3 weeks ago." The boy instantaneously like, "Well, I don't believe in God anyway, so is done. Sorry if you guys hear the fireworks in the background. You know, people are celebrating 4th of July. And then his only people who are kind of dealing with grief in a weird way are his three daughters, who are like witches. And then probably Tom Hanks' character as a grandfather. Like, look, I want to bury your mother and my daughter regularly and normal. And those are the only two or three instances of grief. And most of the people dealing with grief are Tom Hanks' character and the daughters, his granddaughters, when they interact. And that's the first, his first time meeting them, and then the end of the movie. Those two scenes. Mm-hmm. And then you have the clip of Adrian Brody and the waitress from the menu saying, I'm leaving you, and that's it. Other than that, the movie doesn't really delve in lots. Unlike Tar, which is a study of a person and how power corrupts them. You see her gradual journey of everything's fine then to the point where she loses everything. Or, like, Waves. Waves is also a movie dealing with loss. You know, and mm-hmm. how a person heals and overcomes all those issues. This movie does not spend much time developing or expounding upon those theories and themes at all. It goes, here's what the story's about, and goes right to the kooky stuff. So.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like he sacrificed real moments of, like, humanity for his style. Yeah. And that's what the other person was saying, where he was like, it feels like all of these actors are, like, bending and twisting their way in to try to fit Wes's style of filmmaking. And that deadpan delivery that all the characters do, I feel like that really brought, it really dragged down what could have been an interesting study in grief and loss. Because everyone's being a little bit off and a little bit weird and a little bit quirky. Because that's how Wes, you know, creates his characters. It's interesting, I was watching something else where they were talking about his earlier work. And it seems like movies like Royal Tenenbaums and stuff like that, this wasn't that much of an issue. It actually was really about, you know, I actually really like that film on reflection. Like, because it's about a family, like, who are, Ben Stiller's character specifically is a father dealing with grief. And it's just a man trying to, like, get back with his ex-wife. And the family is kind of messed up and crazy, but, like, there's a lot of heart to that. And I feel like somewhere along the way that might have gotten lost. And I didn't really notice it in The French Dispatch. Because to me, and this is another thing that I saw where people were like, The French Dispatch was like, it had no focus, it had no center. And I disagree with that. I very much feel like each vignette, each little story was very focused on exactly what they were trying to say. And I understood perfectly what those messages were. So I don't feel like it was kind of messy or he had too many ideas and or whatever. Like, it all made sense to me. But I feel like this is a film where it's like, there isn't that heart that there could have been in it. And it feels like in an effort to perpetuate his own style and his own way of making movies and what he's been known for, he lost whatever human storytelling there could have been in those moments.
Yeah. This is probably one of those cases of the Tarantino effect, where a director kind of feels himself a little bit too much, because even you mentioned his Royal Tenenbaums, that's a study of a family, like, dealing with divorce, moving on, you know, siblings who aren't really siblings but in love with each other. There's a lot of stuff going on, a lot of human pieces in that story that he touches, interacts with. You know, Grand Budapest Hotel is kind of like a bit of a heist movie, spy thriller-esque in a way. Those elements are mixed in. One of my favorites, Rushmore, with Jason Schwartzman again and Bill Murray. You know, Jason Schwartzman plays an overconfident high school kid. You know, Bill Murray's character is a man going through the midst of a midlife crisis, and how those two, like, come to a head, how those human pieces interact. So he's had a history of doing those character studies in a lot of his work. Fantastic Mr. Fox, overconfident, cocky, overassured, gets himself in trouble, and now has to, like, get himself out of a serious moment. Like, he has those intimate character studies in his projects, but this is the one movie where it does not happen. And that's the thing, where I think people look at Wes's projects and see the colors and how beautiful, how bright it is, and how he can work the comedy in it, where you kind of don't get the actual story. In this case, the story was sacrificed for a lot of those other aspects in it. Yeah, and you see that nothing more than the fact that how many people pop up in this movie. It reminds me of the early to mid-2000s, where they were just doing a bunch of these ensemble cast movies. Like, I think one of them was like Movie 24, and, you know, Halle Berry and all these other celebrities pop up intermittently throughout the movie. This movie felt like that. Like, oh, here's a cameo by, you know, like, by this person or that person out of nowhere. Like, Jeff Goldblum pops out of nowhere. Oh, Margot Robbie just pops to the end. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. It felt like most of the people did this film just because they were friends with Wes Anderson. Like,
yeah.
Like, they were just like, yeah, sure, I'll show up. And that's another issue. This movie was overstuffed. Just with way too many people, too many characters, way too many cameos. And it's unfortunate because, like, I wanted to see what these actors would do in one of Wes's films. Like, I was actually interested to see, like, what they would bring in the context of his very specific way of making movies. So, for instance, a character like Steve Carell's character, who's, like, the motel manager, they didn't really give him much to do. And I'm like, this is Steve Carell, like, one of our best comedy actors, one of our best dramatic actors as well. Like, why didn't we not give him more? I just felt like they didn't really do much with him at all. And then Hong Chau, who plays Adrian Brody's wife, was in there for like a second and then she was out of there. And I was like, what? It would have been so cool to see her actually, like, be a part of this movie because she's such a great actress. And I don't know, I just felt like they got, like, the best people and then they didn't use them, really.
Yeah.
And that was very disappointing, I have to say. I was just like, And it would be different if it was, like, actors who recur in his movies often. So, like, let's just say that Tilda Swinton had, like, a bit part in this. That would have made more sense to me than having, like, a new actor who hasn't been in one of your films yet having a very reduced role, and you're using them for only, like, maybe a minute or two. Yeah, I didn't like that. Because I'm just like, why aren't you using all of these really good actors? Because he put it on the poster, like, you're like, hey, all these folks are going to be in here. And, like, it's just okay. It's, like, great. I get to see Jeff Goldblum for like 1 second and then he's off screen. Like, it's just kind of, I don't know, it just, again, it seems like there were great ideas and then he was just like, I'm gonna just do whatever I want on this one, and he did. So I will say, in terms of the performances, Jason Schwartzman did a great job. I really liked his performance in this. Scarlett Johansson did a great job as well. And I think, who else did, like, a decent job? The kid, the young actor, the one who plays his son.
Yeah.
I loved him. He was my favorite character in the whole movie. But, like, everyone else was just kind of there. And I think even Tom Hanks wasn't used as much as I wish they would have used him. Yeah, it kind of felt like there wasn't enough for people to do because there were so many characters in this. So
yeah, I really wish they had just focused on the actual movie. Like, I don't need to know, yes, Jason Schwartzman's playing Augie Steinbeck and also playing the actor playing Steinbeck. I don't need that scene of, you know, all of a sudden the boy who's playing his son is also his understudy and is interacting with Margot Robbie. Not Margot Robbie, but Scarlett Johansson on a train because she left production. Because now I'm also thinking, how the hell did he get on the train and catch up to her as well? You know, I didn't like I didn't need that. Like, they could have had Bryan Cranston there as kind of like an homage in a way, because his character felt very much like, because he's playing kind of like a Ross Stone character, like a Twilight Zone host.
You're right.
He could have still been in there without the part of the play. You know, they could have just introed it like a Twilight Zone type episode. And it would have worked, because it's dealing with the same sci-fi cookiness of that time period. He could have did the whole Ross Stone, this is a story of how a sleepy mid southern town or whatever Midwest town falls in the entrails of an alien invasion, and just do a whole like parody comedy-esque riff on War of the Worlds in Wes Anderson style. And it probably would have did much better. You know? So and all those like and it's not even, I'm looking at the like the Wikipedia as we're talking about this. Jeff Goldblum had another part in this movie.
Really?
He was the alien that pops up.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
That's where that scene where he takes off the head.
Yeah. So
that's where I saw him.
Yeah. But because it's a black and white, I wasn't really focused on his costuming. I was just like, oh, that's just Jeff Goldblum popping up. But it's like, I really like, if they had not done that show within a show stuff, this probably would have been a lot better. Or focus on one. Don't do both. Focus on one. You know? So.
Yeah. I totally agree. I feel like the play was a step in the complete wrong direction. Like, that was the biggest mistake. It really dragged this movie down for real for me. Because, again, the alien stuff and them being in the desert, like, that was so good. Even, like, let's just say that he still wanted to play around with the themes of grief and stuff, and he didn't go as in depth with it as he could have. I would have been able to forgive that had it not also been for the fact that it doesn't even matter, because this is a play. Like, this isn't even, like, these characters are made up, their experiences are false, like, all of it's just pretend. So I'm like, I can't even care enough to like go on this journey with you, because you've already told me that it doesn't matter. I think that's just it. It's just like, if you don't care, then why should I? I guess that's my biggest gripe. It's like, why did you make this? Like, what were you really trying to say here? I don't know. Because there are really strong aspects of this film. Like, obviously the production design is always going to look great.
Yeah.
Like, because it's one of his films, and the cinematography and the music and the performances were really good as well. And it was funny. Like, the stuff in there was hilarious. Like, I loved Maya Hawke being the teacher and the kids, like, only caring about the alien invasion and not wanting to talk about their schoolwork. Like, that felt real to me. But every single time we had to like pop right back into the play, I was just like, stop it. Like, just let me enjoy this. Like, just let me enjoy this desert, weird Area 54, whatever. Like, let's just do that. Because it did feel kind of in vain with what we just experienced, which was quarantine, which was all of us having to be inside, locked down, and to figure something else out, which is what was also a part of this, or a part of the movie inside of the play, or the play that was the movie, whatever. So if we just stuck with that, I felt like that would have landed so much better. And I would have been like, yes, this movie's good. Like, this movie's really good. The back and forth, he's known for doing stories within a story within a story. Like, he's known for doing that. But for this one, it just
disjointed.
Didn't work at all.
Yeah. Yeah, which sucks, because I feel like this movie is a massive waste of all these talented people. So, you know, like, I hope there's like, once this, because I think this movie hasn't got the return they were expecting from it, based on all the feelings that we are expressing in this podcast right now from fans of Wes's work, where I think by the 22nd, or the 21st of July, it's already going to be on digital platforms. I'm probably going to be that person who probably gets the movie and then re-edits it, so it's just the story of them in the desert avoiding all the black and white stuff, you know. Mm-hmm. So, and I think, was it, like, yeah, it's just, yeah.
What were you gonna say?
It's just a waste. Like, you got, like, fucking, what? What's my Jeffrey Wright in there as a general? Who's like, he's one of those, there's like a list of actors in Hollywood who I think are very gifted at oration and narration, giving like sequence of dialogue. You know, of course, Defoe is one of those actors as well. Like, you give him a nice speech, he's good. Like, Tilda Swinton, like, just so wasted. Although the two bright spots, honestly, of this movie were, honestly, of course, Scarlett. Like, people forget Scarlett can legit act. Like, people have gotten confused by her run as like Black Widow and Marvel stuff. Like, Scarlett's bread and butter for large portions of career were her doing indie stuff, like, and like, and doing some serious acting. People forget that because they just see her as like a pretty face and a sex symbol. But Scarlett Loki is probably one of the most gifted actors at right now who does not get her due. And Maya Hawke, like, beyond like Stranger Things, this showed Maya Hawke's immense talent, because now you see her being playing two contrasting characters, whereas, you know, Robin's kind of quiet but still easily excitable. You know, she's playing a bit more demure of a teacher, like her character, like two different characters, and she still knocks out the park. You know, of like genetics are amazing, because she's like just a good actress as her mother and father, so she lucked out on that genetic lottery. But, you know, I'm not gonna do the nepo baby thing, but I do think she did an amazing job with that as well. But other than that, and I guess maybe the typical Moonrise Kingdom callback of Augie and, I guess, Shelley, who is Scarlett Johansson's, her daughter, in the movie, like, that kind of callback to, you know, Moonrise Kingdom in a way, or even Grand Budapest, where it's young love kind of thing. But other than that, the movie just didn't move me in the typical Wes Anderson ways.
Yeah, I felt nothing. Like, I actually felt nothing. But yeah, I will say all the kids, I loved their stuff. That one kid who like called his friend, even though they were under strict orders not to reach out to anyone, I loved that. Like, it was things like that where I was like, this, like, there is a good movie here, because like, I'm seeing it, I'm engaging with it. And I really enjoyed all of their stuff. I thought that Jason Schwartzman and Scarlett Johansson were like really good, kind of bouncing off of each other. I wish they had a little bit more there, but I think that for what it was, I think they did a really great job. And Maya Hawke, who hasn't really gotten like an opportunity really to like show off her acting chops for real. She did a BBC series, Little Women. She did one of those, but I never watched that, so I don't know what she did in that. But I do know, like, in Stranger Things and also in Due Revenge, her acting choices are a little... But I'm just going to limit that to the writing.
I'm sorry. If you're a visual person, sorry. My dog is kind of scared of fireworks and thunderstorms, so he's now in my lap. Sorry, Cindy, for distracting you. But he's been scratching at my leg the whole time, so...
This is my favorite performance of hers so far. And I think that she has a lot of talent, a lot of promise. And again, I wanted to see more of her. I wanted to see more of Teacher June. I like the character a lot. But yeah, overall, like, I love The French Dispatch because the writing was phenomenal. And it was somewhat grounded in reality because the writers were reflecting real life people. So it felt more realistic, along with Wes's like surrealist, quirky, you know, style. But this one, like, I felt nothing. I left feeling nothing. It was bad.
Yeah. The only other bright spot that kind of comes to my mind are Liv Schreiber being a black parent and telling your son, don't do that. If you touch it, I'm a beat. I'm a break it. I'm sorry. Like him interacting with that boy who just wanted to do stupid shit for attention, that was genuinely funny. But beyond that, like those few bright spots, I was like, this movie is not, not hitting the way it should.
Yeah, it just didn't hit. Yeah. All right.
Look, stop fighting me. All right, you came into my lap. I'm trying to...
You know what this reminds me of? There was this Actors on Actors interview with Nicole Kidman and Kristen Stewart where her dog just kept, like, walking into the frame. It was so hilarious. Because the anger Kristen got, the funnier Nicole Kidman got. Yeah. It was just, like, the best interview. Anyways, this is what this reminds me of.
Dogs don't care. Like, this man is just...
They don't care that you're doing something.
Just fidgeting around and then, like, now he wants to play with me and look at my face. Like,
I love it.
Moving on to the box office. So, of course, it's a big, big weekend. Indiana Jones is back. It's kind of getting a very mixed reaction based on in social media. Some are saying that as bad as it was at the time, that probably Crystal Skull with Shia LaBeouf probably had a better ending and was probably the appropriate send-off for this character. And there are those who are kind of like, we love Indiana Jones, we don't care what you think, the movie's good. So I'm kind of in both camps. I mean, if you decide to, you know, do like people do, call the machete cut with Star Wars and move Crystal Skull after this, I don't know, maybe we'll see how that, I haven't seen this movie, so I can't say, but it hasn't had the response box office wise as they expected. They were expecting about 100 million opening on weekend, and also the budget for the movie was close to about 30 million. So far it's only turned a 60 million dollar profit in the box office. It's kind of shocking, but it also, it's not something I don't expect, because even though we're in the era of the IP, Indiana Jones, for all things considered, is an older IP that doesn't have any of the modern cultural relevance, like you would say the Marvel Cinematic Universe or, you know, Batman, Superman, Spider-Man, who have comic books that are currently in your social sphere as much. Or so this movie is kind of only gonna attract an older fan base, probably your 30-ish year old males and up. So yeah, it's not surprising.
I've only heard negative things about this movie. Yeah. So I don't know how that's gonna work out for them. And it's interesting because, like, once Mission Impossible comes out, like, that's going to do big numbers. And that has been going on since I was a child.
Yeah.
So.
And that's the thing. Like, Mission Impossible is a more, it's an IP that's always been currently. It's like with Indiana Jones, it ended after, like, the 80s. It did a crappy show like the 90s, I think, with River Phoenix, I think it's Young Indiana Jones or whatever. It did that. It wasn't that good. I think it only lasted like one season. And then flash forward, they do Crystal Skull, and then they do this. Like, Indiana Jones was not something that was always in culture, like, say, like what you said, Mission Impossible, or, you know, James Bond, or even short-term Jason Bourne. So yeah.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, on to other news. So, Michael Imperioli says that he has decided to forbid bigots and homophobes from watching The White Lotus and The Sopranos, and I guess like any other thing that he's been in response to the Supreme Court rulings. I saw that.
I'm making faces with my dog if you guys are able to watch.
Okay. I love it. It's a mess and I love it. The actor's statement comes after the day after the Supreme Court signed an exception to a law that would allow businesses to discriminate based on sexual orientation, as well as overturn affirmative action and killed student loan forgiveness. So he continued saying, "Thank you, Supreme Court, for allowing me to discriminate and exclude those who I don't agree with and I'm opposed to." He said, "Hate and ignorance is not a legitimate point of view, and America is becoming dumber by the minute." You know, obviously he can't enforce anyone to like not watch the shows or the films that he's been in, but it is, this past weekend has been rough. I will say that it's been a rough week after the decision to have came down based on a majority conservative Supreme Court. And it's just, it's rough because it's like, what are, like, what happens now? What are we supposed to do? And the fact that the Supreme Court has like such unlimited and kind of unchecked power, there isn't really much you can do about them specifically, like the people making the decisions that affect, you know, the entire country, because of their own personal beliefs and their own personal preferences. It sucks. Keep it brief. It sucks.
Yeah, the only way, and I think the only way you can kind of flip like Supreme Court rulings on those kind of things, because, you know, checks and balances, every Supreme Court, like, everybody kind of keeps each other in check, so you need at least two sides to agree on something for it to work. And the current state of the how Congress set up, so it has, I guess, conservative control just like the Supreme Court does, the odds are of the president and Congress being able to overturn the Supreme Court rulings. It's like this ruling, which the case is based on, frivolous, because I guess the person that was mentioned in the case as wanting the cake, a journalist actually decided to do due diligence, I'm sorry, and contact them. Turns out that person's A, didn't order a cake from them, and B, is in a heterosexual marriage with kids, and he's like, that's not me. So that ruling passed on the farce, and that, I think that's ethically and legally illegal. So we'll see how that goes, because this is going to be an ongoing thing. But yeah, and I've already seen cries of, I know we don't want to get political, but he brought it up about how he's like, I don't want these people watching my work. I've seen cries of other people, you know, doing the same thing. Oh, now that, you know, Congress or Supreme Court said, I can say I don't want these people watch my stuff. Now those people from conservative backgrounds are complaining about not being able to participate and enjoy certain things. Now this, you get what you reap what you sow. So that's all I'm gonna say on that. But on the ongoing world of Hollywood strikes, SAG-AFTRA and the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers have agreed to extend their current TV and film contracts until July 11th to allow bargaining on a new deal to continue, both sides said this evening. Recently, I think late last week, a letter of about 300 or 3,000-ish actors, a letter came out saying they were for a strike, and it featured, of course, Quinta Brunson and a lot of top-of-the-line actors and actresses who I think some of them are also writers and producers themselves, which is, it's amazing how Hollywood these lines can get blurred, which union you're a part of. So we'll see how that goes. The initial agreement was set to expire, I think, 12 o'clock East Coast time. And now it's going to expire like 2 weeks later. So see how that goes. I mean, the writers union is still striking. Directors got what they wanted. But I do think the issue of AI is probably what's dragging out the deal for SAG-AFTRA. The same core issue that the Writers Guild has, the Actors Union has, but they have a lot more flexibility because we might not have writers, but a director can be us a script and we can still shoot. but without actors, you can't do anything. So,
yeah, that'll shut everything down. I was like, oh, this is going to be really bad. Yeah. I was hopeful initially because the president of SAG-AFTRA, which is Fran Drescher, who knew, was like, yeah, we're talking and things are going really well. And I was like, great. And then this letter came out with about 2,000 actors like Jennifer Lawrence and Meryl Streep and like Mark Ruffalo, like very top people saying like, no, we're going to strike if we don't get substantial, you know, changes met. And I was like, okay, well, that's not good. And then the deadline was getting closer and closer and there wasn't any news. And I was like, please don't do this. Because I think one thing that we're noticing, and we'll really see it, we'll see it like later next month or later this month when you have Mission Impossible, Barbie and Oppenheimer coming out. There's not really much press. You know, like you can't really do interviews like you do. I mean, you can do it overseas, but here the late night talk show is like how people move their movies around. Like that's what's getting people excited about like seeing these films. And these films are going to do well regardless. Like it doesn't even matter. They don't even need the press, to be honest. Like people are going to go see them. But I do think that when we start getting into like fall, winter, when people are really like campaigning for movies to be nominated for stuff, if you don't have those options or those outlets to really get your movie out there, especially for a smaller film, I feel like that's really going to hurt the movies or people's ability to go to even know about them or, you know, not get the box office that they may want for it. So I was like, please, I was like, can we figure something out, please? And then they extended it to July 12th. And I was like, okay, alive another day, I guess. But yeah, I feel like one of the issues that I'm having is like, why is AI such a stronghold for the producers? Like, why does it mean so much to them to keep it? Because I really do feel like that's probably the reason why these negotiations haven't reached a conclusion.
Well, it's kind of the issue initially when the internet was becoming a thing, and then the idea of like Netflix suddenly outdid Blockbuster and Hollywood Video and terrestrial video rental places. Like I think I mentioned this before, but Mike Shore mentioned this in on a radio show. When internet and the idea of streaming and stuff, all those, this is like, excuse me, man. It was like during when Napster and all those things were a thing and they were already streaming music and stuff, they said this is going to be a potential platform for entertainment. You're going to want to do the same thing. Excuse you. You're excused. You're excused. My co-host is the animal co-host.
Your co-host.
My other co-host is barking into my mic as I talk or sneezing. But now I lost my train of thought. Oh yeah. So they were like vehemently like producers and the Motion Deal Alliance was like, yeah, we don't think it's gonna happen, and then it did. So a lot of these unions have realized we told you about internet and what's gonna happen, you ignored us. And now you're putting stuff on your platforms and then when it doesn't want to make you money, you strip it off your platform and you write it off as a loss. Is what we've seen Warner Brothers do consequently for like the last year of just writing everything off that they failed on. And for the writers, it's more so them not getting paid or residuals from streaming. And then also once the zeitgeist, whatever, or the industry has no use for that project, it gets taken off of platforms with no digital releases. Like you had an actress, I forgot her name. Everybody knows watches Bob Burgers. The actress, she plays the youngest Belcher kid. I forget her name. But she was on Twitter and she was like, hey, the show I did for Disney Plus, it's off and I can't show my daughter it and I really want to. Does anybody help me? And like a random fan like ripped that show from streamers and sent her a custom DVD. Like things like that. Like once it's gone, it's gone. Like, unless people have archived and conserved it. And I know for actors, it's more so with AI. And it was kind of iffy with the whole deepfake thing, because at the time, people were just being horny and nasty and just making porn with it. And that was also an issue within itself. And now it's gone beyond that, where you have people, like, dubbing, like, Michael B. Jordan ads or making a fake Ryan Reynolds ad, where it's gone beyond the little infancy stage. It has gotten bigger. So,
yeah. My question was, okay, well, why is that? Why are the studios so determined to keep that part of the equation?
Because, like, we've seen, like, okay, we've seen a bunch of movies just digitally take actors' appearances. You know, we've seen it with recently with The Flash. It used Christopher Reeve's appearance. I heard about that. We've seen, of course, we've seen Italian dessert commercials using Audrey Hepburn's face when she was younger. So they're already and we've seen even with Marvel, with Star Wars. Grand Moff Tarkin, Peter Cushing, he died. They brought him back for Rogue One digitally. And it's things like that, like, they're going to try and word these contracts to where we own, like, your name and likeness of this character so we can use in perpetuity, whether you're dead or alive. And I think that's supposed to be one of the things actors are concerned about, because then at least their estate with nothing because of the way the contracts are written. And it already kind of happens to a degree, because when you buy these toys or you play these games or you even look at some of the comic books nowadays, a lot of the superhero characters look like the actors and actresses who've played them on screen. So,
yeah, I guess my thing is, like, okay, well, how, you can't really, to me, that doesn't seem like a long-term solution. Like, it doesn't seem like something that you can continue to do and expect that, like, it's going to work. Like, what are you going to do? Give an Oscar to an AI program? Like, come on. Like, you need the real performers to be there. And even if they die, I feel like they have the right to reserve their image and their likeness. Like, you don't, the studio doesn't or shouldn't have control over that at all. Like,
we say that, but Prince is one of the biggest artists in Hollywood or in the world who spoke out vehemently against the idea of his name, image, likeness be used for other stuff. After his death, you know, his family allowed Justin Timberlake to have a hologram-ish thing of him at the Super Bowl. His family re-released music of his that he had in the vault. You know, it's also that, like, people going against your wishes. And for the studios, it's more so, well, I don't have to pay the actor. I own your likeness. I have digital recordings of your voice. I can add, splice, use it, make an AI say all your dialogue. I don't have to pay you anymore. The millions of dollars I spend on you, oh, you want $20 million for this movie? Oh, that $20 million could be diverted to all the other departments, as far as, like, my VFX and my sound, and I don't need and do motion capture like they've shown is possible with Avatar and all these video games like God of War. Like, I don't need to have the actor on set. I can have anybody else mocap and pretend to be you and digitally insert your voice in it. So.
Okay, so they're trying to cut costs, like, deeply. Yeah. But my thing is, like, this is so, yeah, I would have so many issues. Like, I would also be on in the negotiations, like, going off. Because it's like, first of all, it's like, you guys don't know how to budget your films correctly. Like, you're spending so much money on these movies expecting that they're going to, that you're gonna match your box office and then get more than that, which would actually cover all of your costs.
Yeah.
But you're putting your money in the wrong places. You're overpaying actors, like, who are really just, like, there to phone in performances and then leave. Like, I'm not gonna mention any names, but there are actors who are, like, you know, these like Netflix action movies where it's like, it could have been anybody else cast in the role, you probably could have gotten them from cheaper. No one saw the film anyways, and you're paying them like $45 million. You know, it's like, maybe rethink where you're spending your money instead of trying to, like, cut corners and, like, not pay actors. So yeah, anyways, in conclusion, I am definitely on the actor side. I will be personally sad if they go on strike, just because like that means we don't get to see them for a while. And as a person who is doing this, loves pop culture, like it's very, it'll be tough on my spirits. It won't change anything in my life, but it will, you know, but you know, it's not ideal, I guess. And it won't be ideal for them either. I feel like for the bigger actors, they have the security net of money. So like they don't actually need to do these things. But for they're not the only people who are in the union. There are other actors who are like doing commercials and stuff like
that.
Up and comers doing smaller movies, and this will have an impact on them for real. So I hope that they can figure this out. I hope that the writers also figure out their stuff, because they've been on strike for a while. But I do like the solidarity that everyone is bringing, like every portion of the entertainment industry is like coming together to really support each other. Like I saw photos of like Tom Cruise holding up a Barbie and Oppenheimer ticket, because he's going to go see both of them. And like, everyone's really excited about both of those movies, even though they come out on the same day, but everyone's being like super supportive of each other's films. And I think that that's really cool. So I like whatever's happening now, where everyone's kind of like joining together instead of being super competitive and like, you're over there and I'm here. I think that's cool. But yeah, I hope they figure this out, because this is like, Hollywood is not doing well right now. Like,
no. And I know we've kind of went a bit on this, but this issue goes, it's the state of the Hollywood. It goes beyond the strikes, because even with them removing stuff from digital, their distribution networks, somebody mentioned this before, with the ballooning price of these movie budgets and the expectation to double or triple those things, you no longer have those mid-budget films that really astound you and amaze you and end up drawing millions in box office, because everybody's committing those multi-million dollar, almost billion dollar budgets to these movies that don't make it. Like, they're spending $300 million on a movie that barely makes $200 million. And before, like in the early 2000s or in the 90s, you had a movie that would be like, oh yeah, this movie was like $50 million, and it went on to make like $500 million, and you're like, oh wow, that movie did amazing. Like, you don't get those mid-budget films anymore, and we don't have those cult classics anymore, where it didn't do good theatrically, but it made it back up in DVD and VHS sales. Like, Blade Runner theatrically did not do well, but guess what, still pop culture zeitgeist, to the point where it's a cult classic that everybody loves, to the point where Hollywood's like, lo what, everybody still likes this IP, let's do a Blade Runner sequel. Like, we're not gonna have those anymore, because those spaces for those movies that would end up on a streaming platform, oh, it didn't do the money we wanted, all right, we can delete it. So and those mid-budget movies are where you found a lot of like old Hollywood, like, cut their teeth, like, and when I say mid-budget, I also include, not when I say indie, I don't mean like A24 indie, because those A24 movies that they do on their own have big budgets, but yeah, a lot of other indie movies that they'd only dedicate like $1 million, $10 million to or whatever, those are the movies where a lot of current stars in Hollywood, like I mentioned Scarlett Johansson earlier, like, they cut their teeth. Like, her, Mark Ruffalo, like, they cut their teeth doing a lot of those mid-budget, you know, movies, and they're at, like, the heights of celebrity now. And we don't, like, we're picking people who stream to 14 and 15-year-olds on YouTube and are famous on TikTok and hoping and praying that they draw that fan base in on Netflix, and that's why we have so many of these blonde white girls who can't act on Netflix at the moment, and because Netflix has locked them into 10-year contracts thinking they hit a diamond in the rough when they certainly haven't. So yeah, Hollywood's shot itself in the foot. I don't know, I should not use that metaphor. That's a bad metaphor to use in light of a lot of stuff that's happened, but Hollywood has created the problems that are happening in Hollywood are self-inflicted by these producers. So
yeah, and also, like, where like you said before, like, where are we supposed to find these movies? Like, they just delete them off of their streaming service, and there aren't any, like, physical copies of them. Yeah. That's wild. Anyway, the world is burning. Okay, so what did we watch this week?
I had a busy week, very tiring. I didn't have a chance to watch anything, so hopefully with it being 4th of July, after we're done recording, and hopefully I can spend most of the day catching up on stuff. I had initially planned to, of course, watch Indiana Jones, we mentioned earlier, probably tomorrow. I missed out on my screening ticket before it came out, because my dad did something, and he was the one pushing me to watch because he loves Indiana Jones, but I missed out on that, so I'm probably going to watch it tomorrow. So,
sounds good.
And be disappointed based on our current reviews.
Looking forward to that review next week. I watched Charade, which is a movie with Audrey Hepburn and Cary Grant. Yes. Cary Grant. Is it Cary Grant? I think it's Cary Grant. There are like three or four,
four or five movies together.
Hollywood actors who I always confuse with each other. So I think it's Cary Grant. Let's just say that's true. No, he was in North by Northwest, right?
Yeah.
Yes, it's Cary Grant. Absolutely. Boom. And this movie was very interesting. Basically, it's like a woman whose husband dies, and he owes people money, and so the people who wants the money from him is like hunting her down to find the money, and it's just like it's so like old Hollywood, just in the way that the story is told, like it's just ridiculous, but it's also. It's also funny. I think Cary Grant is so charming that like it makes up for whatever the film lacks. Like he brings like a certain kind of energy that just elevates the material. Because even Audrey Hepburn, I think she was really funny in this role, but her acting style, there's like one or two movies where you'll catch her doing something that feels a little bit more meaty in terms of like her performance. And I've watched a lot of her movies because I'm like a super fan. I love her so much. So, but she does have a way of being like, what? Oh, no. Like that, you know, that like
campy
mid-Atlantic, like good golly, like kind of, you know, very artificial, like over-exaggerated performance style. She has a tendency to do that a lot. And she's so beautiful that you don't think about it. But like, I think there are some moments where it's just like, okay, like I don't, that's not like the acting choices were questionable sometimes, but overall, I thought this movie was funny. The fight scenes, old timey fight scenes make me laugh more than anything in this world. Like, it's so funny because if I'm not mistaken, like The Last Samurai and Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon?
Yeah.
Those movies were made back in like the 50s, right?
What? I'm not...
No, they weren't made in the 50s and the 60s.
Crouching Tiger and Hidden Dragon and Last Samurai?
The seven Swords of Samurai?
You mean The Seven Samurai? What?
Yeah. Those movies weren't made. Wait, yeah, when were those movies made?
Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, and The Last Samurai was made about between 2000 and 2007. Because Last Samurai is Tom Cruise. Last Samurai is a Tom Cruise movie. We were like, you know how
no,
people.
No, not him. Not that movie.
You said Last Samurai.
And it's not that one.
But those are what you said, though.
That's not what I mean though. Like there are other, I feel like, okay, I have to.
Crouching Tiger was like 2003. That's
Kurosawa, right?
Kurosawa. Let me talk about, yeah. Seven Samurai.
Yes, him.
Yeah.
Was that not made back in the day? That was made in 2000?
No, it was made back in the day.
That was made back in the day.
Yes,
you meant. I'm confusing two different things.
You're confusing two different things. Yeah.
Okay, that's what I meant.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
I was like, girl, what are you talking about? Like 50s, what?
Yeah, no, that's not that. That wasn't what I meant. I meant the Seven Samurai. That had, like, historically incredible action sequences, right?
Yeah.
Some, like, it's not like you can't do it. It's just for some reason in these movies, the action always is so artificial and hilarious and just, like, unserious. I don't know. It makes me laugh. I just feel like we can do better on those fronts, and I didn't.
Well,
maybe they could have, or maybe they couldn't. I'm not sure.
Well, that was also, I think the reason for that, when you're talking about Seven Samurai and you're comparing it to Hollywood movies of that same era-esque, it also was for cultural reasons as to why. Like, when you think American pop culture and the superhero archetype, you think cowboys, and that didn't come really into vogue until like the 60s, and that's when they started doing your westerns and your shootouts, and so it took a while for Hollywood to say, hey, people like to see action, and then they basically copied Seven Samurai, you know,
right.
So
they did it later is what you're saying. They didn't do it at this period.
No.
That's probably why it looks like that. Anyways, it's a fun little romp if you have the time to watch it. It's fun. The costumes are fabulous. Like, when I tell you that whoever does the costume for though, like back in the day, on another level, like every costume that she wore looked incredible. And maybe because, again, maybe it's Audrey Hepburn, like, I guess she could wear anything and it would still look nice, but, like, I don't know. There's something about, because even when I was watching Casablanca, I was like, yes, the fashion is on point. So I don't, maybe it was because they got actual designers to design the collection, like a collection for the character, and I don't think they do that anymore. So I guess you kind of miss out on that. But
I mean,
either way.
Back then, they also spent more time when they're designing the wardrobe. They also designed it with the actor, actress in mind a little bit more than they do now.
Which is true.
So,
yeah, that is very true.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, this has been a very long experience. So, we're going to wrap it up. We hope that you guys are taking care of yourselves and you're having a great week. Make sure to check out all of our social media. Support us if you can. Have a great Independence Day, or a Malia Obama Day, if you know, you know.
What?
And it's her birthday tomorrow.
Malia Obama?
So people, that's like a in joke in the Black community. It's like, we don't acknowledge
it. I probably missed that meeting. I missed that meeting.
Yeah. We acknowledge it as Malia Obama Day, not. So. Anyway, then we'll see you in the next episode. Goodbye.
Goodbye.